or a hundred and eight pages. You can't explain anything anymore. Long protracted, and then you start thinking about it, and you go, all right.
Okay.
So if you make it legally, you can do two sentences per page.
Three, two, four, rolling.
Okay, we'll call this March 21st, 2017, meeting of the Springfield Planning Commission to order. This is a work session today, and this was really called at our request. Greg Mott is here tonight, and Christina Schmunk-Krez will be joining us. And really, our point of discussion tonight, we've had several cell tower requests come before us within the last several months, and several of the seated commission were not here when we revamped the cell tower code. And so Greg's going to give us some background and oversight and discuss that. Certainly it's a work session, so if you have any questions as we go through this process, certainly get them out on the table and we'll move forward. So.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Christina and I have kind of an agreed upon strategy to try and follow as we make this presentation. And even though it goes against my grain to be brief, we'll try to do that. We're only scheduled for a half an hour, but if you want to stay here 45 minutes, that's obvious, so that's fine. It's up to you. So just so you know what this map is, I asked somebody in our GIS section, person there, if he could locate the cell towers that are subject to our standards of review and put a 2,000-foot circle around them showing, you know, that distant separation that they have to have by our code. And now it only goes up to 23 because that's all the data that our GIS book has. And I can tell you we're at 28 now, not 23. We've had five more since he did this. And I do have the addresses for those five new ones. But the other thing I asked Mike Engelman to do for me was to show the zoning that allows the towers. And so the areas that are gray don't allow towers. So now, and don't confuse this 2,000-foot circle with their broadcast range, because it's not the same thing. It's just location standard. So anywhere in these gray areas, you can't put one of these poles. Only in the park and open space, the green stuff, which we recently amended, was last November, I think, to include park and open space. And then in the industrial, which is the purple, and commercial, you can have the towers. So you can see that between the 2,000-foot separation and the inability to put towers in residential, you can kind of see where the future lies for new towers. Now, this is assuming the technology doesn't change and they continue to need these 150-foot tall towers. And it also assumes that the increase in data demand, because it's at this point it's probably unrealistic to think it's going to be new telephone clients, because I don't know anybody who doesn't have a cell phone, to be honest, but there are some people that don't have a there are some people that don't have much of a data plan.
Yeah.
And particularly kids, and then as they get older, then they get them. So that's what the effect has been lately, is this this load that's being, this load demand primarily from data, so that's why we have these additional towers. Then they also have the problem with the larger buildings and the demand that's generated them, such as the Gateway Mall. So anyway, that's what this map is about. So to get back on our schedule, it's your turn.
So I was going to just briefly talk about the federal regulatory sort of umbrella for this. And most land use areas, you know, our state provides a lot of regulations about how land use can be done and what processes have to be followed. But there are very few areas in which the federal government regulates in terms of land use. But one area that they have regulated are cell phone towers, personal wireless services. So there are sort of three things that are, I think, the most important mandates from the federal government. One has come up more recently, and that's that local governments cannot regulate on the basis of environmental effects of radio transmissions. So any concerns about health effects or other environmental issues that could be related to the radio frequencies or the radio transmissions or electromagnetic radiation from cell towers cannot be a basis for a local government decision in how they regulate either specific towers or in their scheme of regulation in general. That area is preserved for the federal government. So the city can make sure that providers are following the standards set by the federal government, and the city or city officials could weigh in on federal government rulemaking and how they want to regulate those, but we can't directly regulate on those potential effects. So then that's the sort of express preemption, like this is what you cannot in any circumstance do. Then there are sort of generally more broad preemption mandates about how your scheme of regulation of cell towers has to be devised. And the first requirement is that you can't unreasonably discriminate against providers of functionally equivalent service. So you can't be more favorable to AT&T than you are to T-Mobile, essentially. And you cannot have so that's the first one. The second one is you cannot prohibit or have the effect of prohibiting the provision of wireless services in your jurisdiction. So there's some guidance on what that means, but for the most part, you have to ensure that you are allowing cell towers to go in and enough places in your city that they can fill coverage gaps, that you're not prohibiting service from being provided in certain portions of the jurisdiction. So these standards, although it was prior to my time, they were developed with those two sort of overarching mandates from the federal government in mind, that we don't discriminate between providers of functionally equivalent service, and that we don't prohibit or have the effect of prohibiting personal radio services within the jurisdiction of the city of Springfield.
So another, just taking you back to 1996, when the Telecommunications Act was enacted. A couple of things that were sort of the bread and butter of that. The first was that the federal government's approach to access to telecommunications, whatever that band is, they were approaching it the same way they approached the Rural Electrification Act back in the 20s or whenever the WPA was in existence, and said, then every American deserves electricity. In 1996, they said every American deserves access to a telephone. So some of the things that Christina mentioned about you can't take these actions that have the effect of precluding cell tower in your community or whatever, you know, whatever technique they use to broadcast and receive, you can't create an artificial circumstance that says, oh gee, I guess you're just out of luck, you know, there's no place these things can go. Hence, as you can see, you can probably, the providers by hook or by crook are going to be able to provide every square inch of the city of Springfield with coverage, with as much coverage as they can provide. There's some limitations on each one of those towers about how much load they can have. When they first started, and they were really dealing with phones, they could handle, I think it was 360 calls simultaneously. And once you reached 360, and you were talking on your phone, and you had to be handed off to another tower, if that tower already had 360, remember when you lost your signal back in the day, that's why. Or in some cases, there just wasn't very good coverage. Like if you were going over to Florence, there were some dead spots in there. But the idea is that eventually you should be able to get cell phone coverage in every square inch of this country. Just a few, maybe roadless areas or something, can't do that. The other thing they did is they created these bands that people could bid on to purchase and then could sell to anybody who wanted to provide the service, that particular band, frequency band. And so I think they had quite a few, and they started out, they were like $1 million a piece, and then the demand was so high and they bumped them up. But that I mean, US government was actually selling this frequency band that you could then turn around and start providing phone service for people. They also talked about the hardware infrastructure in communities and the availability of part of that infrastructure for these telecommunications companies to use. The local utilities couldn't deny access on their infrastructure for somebody who wanted to use it for telecommunications. And, you know, in 96, it really was in its infancy. At that time, they were saying they were thinking by 2000, there might be 10,000 cell phone towers in the country in that four-year period. And there were 10 times that in the first year. And they way underestimated what's happened with this business segment. It's really just, and as a personal anecdote, I purchased Nokia stock right after they went public based on my belief that this thing can't miss, absolutely can't. I mean, who can? And Motorola had 80% of the market at the time. Nokia decided they wanted to be number one. So they got very aggressive, and the stock I bought went up 10 times in less than a year. And the only regret I had was I didn't buy it more, 10 times more than I did buy. But that's how fantastic this thing was. We've barely been able to keep up. We had to, that first code that we had, and we had help from the telecommunications folks, they have their own pack, as it were, for the whole industry. They were contacting cities at in the fall of 1996 and saying, if you want our help creating new code for the new law, we'll come down and give you a hand. And we did.
Yeah.
We did. But we also said, listen, we have a responsibility to the community that may, for the most part, it's going to be everybody should get cell tower access or cell phone access. But we have to take in consideration the feds say we can, there's a certain degree of regulation that we can apply, and we regulate everything, so of course we're going to do it to the cell towers too. But we did get buy-off from their industry on the ordinance that we adopted, even to the extent that they then started promoting our ordinance to other communities that hadn't developed one yet, saying, this is the model ordinance, if you do this, you know, you won't have anybody appearing before your council objecting to your ordinance. So that was real heady for us back then. But it only took about 3 years before, you know, we were struggling. So we made some changes, and probably not as comprehensively as we should, and as a result, in 2012 or 13, it was no longer, it didn't fit anything. The regulations that we had, it just were completely inadequate. So the council had a very hands-on interaction with the staff in creating the cell tower ordinance, the WTS ordinance that we have today.
Was it 2013?
I think it was 2013. I know it was 2013 it was adopted. We may have, that process may have begun in 2011.
So, the other thing that we wanted to do was to briefly walk through what some of the standards are in there that maybe sort of have the most flex room or the most discretionary that the Planning Commission can use if you have specific concerns about the location or the setbacks or the aesthetic impact of a cell tower on a particular part of town. So note that, keeping in mind that you can't prohibit or have the effect of prohibiting cell towers, the Ninth Circuit's standard that governs Oregon in terms of what that language means is that you have to provide the least intrusive alternative for providing coverage where your regulations, if strictly applied, would have the effect of prohibiting provision of service. That, if this code is applied correctly, that probably shouldn't come up, but that's good to have in the background because standard is the least intrusive alternative. And that's actually code, that was actually implemented into the code language, those standards are there. So there's general standards and there's specific standards, and those general and specific standards apply to moderate and high visibility towers. They also apply to some low visibility towers, but not all of them are applicable. They're in section F and section G. Section F, things that you're probably familiar with, design for co-location. You have to, if you're designing a tower, design it to structurally accommodate as many other providers as technically practicable. And it's sort of the discretion of the Planning Commission what technically practicable means. It is a legal standard, but you are the ultimate arbiters for these types of decisions that aren't reviewed by City Council of what, if that standard's been met or not. They also need to demonstrate that that there's a need for their new facility and that the proposed facility is the least intrusive alternative, or least intrusive means to close that gap in coverage. The gap in coverage can be voice or it can be data. In 2011, the FCC affirmed that a right to sort of broadband spectrum for data is on the same par as the provision of voice services, so you can't make a distinction. If a carrier comes in and shows you two maps and one that shows that there's a gap in data but no gap in voice, that's not a really a basis to not allow their application. Commissioner Nelson?
Yeah, with regards to like the data, lack of the coverage, is that something where there's one single independent third party that does the analysis, or is it just each individual cell phone tower does their own mapping to determine they have lack of coverage?
So there's a peer review requirement that comes into play with their coverage maps. I can't find that in the code. But the process includes getting peer review of those, independent consultation report. So that's something that the city can opt into and have a can request sort of independent, the applicant pay for independent peer review as one way to validate the information that's highly technical that's provided in their application, so that the city, because the city doesn't have the expertise to know if a coverage map is accurate.
We have not done that.
No.
That's my understanding.
I don't recall that we ever did. I mean, we recognize that the type of engineering that's involved in this, nobody in our division, I don't think anybody in the city has the skill sets to look at that as an engineer and say, yes, this is correct. This was the proper evaluation that took place based on the sort of threshold standard that you have to meet in determining that there's a hole in the coverage, and the way to satisfy that hole is with either a relocated tower or additional towers. And based on the terrain as well as the height of the tower, the area of coverage, they can demonstrate that if they put it here, then we don't have any more dark spots. Or if we add an additional one, then we don't have a gap in our coverage. And that demonstration of the broadcast area has to be performed by one of these engineers with the data that they have and whatever methodology that they use. I'm sure it's a software program. Has to be in this day and age. They're not getting slide rules out and figuring it out. So they provide that to us as part of their application, and it's included in the reports that come before you.
However, it's not an independent peer review.
Correct.
Define an independent peer review. What would you, you know, I mean, like GFOA has a peer review process for finances and things of that nature. And there must be some sort of the same type of a structure that's set up for these types of things, that there are,
that's
an organization.
That's a good question. I don't know if there is.
Would that be like a good condition if it was a controversial site, is to have an
independent
peer review?
The code was independent consultation report, so I would just assume that, and it's not defined in the code, I would assume that that would cover either if there's a trade entity that provides that type of service that could be utilized, or you could find an engineer who's not associated with the applicant to provide that analysis to, I think. It specifically contemplated that this process would be used for something that's proposed inside a residential zoning district, or within 500 feet of residential zoning, or in other areas where a facility would have a visual or aesthetic impact on a sensitive neighborhood. I don't think it's limited to that. I don't think it's limited to that. I think the authority exists to have that conducted for any moderate or high visibility.
So that this would have applied to the one along Pioneer Parkway.
If you had chose to exercise it.
If we would have chosen to exercise it.
Right. And this independent report would address both the lack of coverage, lack of capacity issue, and also the least intrusive means to serve that, because those two standards sort of go hand in hand.
Yeah.
And you do have authority to push back on those criteria. Those are criteria of approval that can be utilized to require more information or make a different decision, or to impose reasonable conditions.
The
on
need
the
and the least intrusive are the two that we really have some jurisdiction over.
And I think there's another one too, which was I believe we had at our meeting that we had together, was on alternate site analysis, which would be to say if there's a number of the applicant.
Right.
Would need to actually show that they've looked at all applicable properties, and either the property owner was not interested in a cell phone, or for some other reason that there was no other site within the coverage gap area.
If you could identify a less intrusive site, if there was some basis to say that this particular site is more intrusive, and so we would require you to have ruled out less intrusive sites. But I don't think there's a code basis to require them to systematically eliminate similarly situated sites. For example, taking the recent application on Pioneer Parkway as an example, to rule out other sites that are also along Pioneer Parkway would not go to any code criteria if what you're caring about is the visual impact on Pioneer Parkway.
Has there been technology where maybe an existing cell tower, they've come in and put in new technology that's boosted their signal? Has that happened?
My limited understanding is that occurs sort of under the leases that they have now without, and it doesn't trigger, so that wouldn't trigger any development review by the city. If they're going from a high visibility to another high visibility, there may be building permits that they might have to get if they're doing certain electrical upgrades or changing those types of things, but it wouldn't trigger a new site plan review or a new discretionary use. We are aware of several providers that are interested in deploying small cells in the right-of-way and have come to the city for those approvals to get small cell installations, which are, if they're considered microcell receivers and are attached to existing light or utility standards, then they're exempted from this review process. So those don't come to the Planning Commission because they've been exempted. But that's one way in which providers are attempting to address coverage gaps in a very unintrusive way.
You might be asking, what's that look like? Are we talking about antennas on the side of buildings or something like that?
So they're...
It's on the pole.
It's on the pole, and it's a, there's sometimes utility cabinets that are attached to those, but they're apparently all over in Portland, and you don't see them, and some have gone into Eugene and will be going into Eugene in the future. But they're sort of, they're defined as stealth or low-impact facilities in our code now, so they're single, for the most part, they're single antennas with associated equipment apparatus on them.
So that's just the, kind of the next gen, so...
Yeah.
You know, we're gonna see probably a push a bit more for this type of cell tower activity into the future, but like Greg indicated, you know, there's gonna be a whole, probably a whole nother generation that's gonna be coming within the next 5 to 10 years that may be much less intrusive, right? Could be.
And it, you know, begs the question about the real, the broadest possible use of the right-of-way, too. Because think of all the utilities that are in there already. And lots of communities have hardwired fiber optic in their right-of-ways. This is obviously another element or another aspect of use of the right-of-way for, this is, you know, it's private, but that Telecommunication Act gives it more credence for its application, because again, if you just go back to square one and say, what we're after here is universal coverage. Mm-hmm. That's what we're trying to, not universal cell phone coverage, so every American can communicate. And this obviously, I mean, all streets have, they may not have telephone poles, and some of them may not have power poles, but they all have street lights. That's just the way it is. So that infrastructure is already in place.
Right.
And it's just a question of negotiating with that community about using the right.
And the FCC is undergoing a rulemaking. They've received a petition from a company called Mobility to sort of make new rules that would, in my opinion, severely limit local jurisdictions' authority over the use of their own right-of-way for those, in terms of what fees could be charged, who would have to have access, local control of the right-of-way.
Yeah.
So the city manager did submit comments on that aspect of that to the FCC earlier this month, and we expect that rulemaking to continue and to, for FCC to rule in some manner on that petition. We don't know what that will look like, but that could, depending on how that came about, that theoretically could necessitate code changes in the future to comply with new FCC rules, but that would be down the road, I think.
Commissioner Landon.
Do we have any of these antennas on top of light poles or power line?
We had one on a water tower, and that was the reason that we're having some other things happen out in that area.
One thing that I'm aware of is that at 69th and Main, there is a pole that is a metal standard that Sub owns, and there is T-Mobile equipment attached to that that would be, if not being small cell, it's sort of similar to what I think we would see for small cell. So I'm aware of that particular one because of other issues that have come up related to that.
At
69th and Main, on the northeast corner of that intersection.
It doesn't reach out the house.
It's not a cell tower. It's telecom equipment attached to a pole. I'm not sure if there's an antenna on that or if it's just an equipment box for some purpose, but I don't know why you have an equipment box without an antenna. So that's one location where I'm aware that there's something. But we're in the process of developing a master agreement that would allow, staff are in the process of developing a master agreement for small cells that would be sort of, in addition to a utility license, it would be a public right-of-way use agreement that would allow telecom companies to install small cells in the right-of-way. So that's being worked on. Before it's executed, that would go to City Council for their approval and sign off. That project is underway right now.
And we would encourage the companies to use existing structures as often as they can.
Absolutely.
We consider those stealth designs. So early on, we had some antenna on a water tank, one of those high-rise water tanks, and you couldn't even see them because they blended into the all the other apparatus that was there. And then we had some on a couple of buildings, a couple of taller buildings, and they just, you know, what they try and do is disguise it, I think, for their own security purposes when they have something like that. So it just looks like a balcony rail or something, and you can hardly even tell. And that's ideal for us, and that's why we just, you can do that. You don't have to get an elaborate approval process from us. You can simply do it. So.
Commissioner Bowes.
You mentioned, Greg, that you now have 28 towers. Mm-hmm. Does that include towers that have been approved but not yet in service, or does that just include those that are in service currently?
Actually, that includes the ones that received approval haven't been installed.
Oh. I noticed number 23 is the one at Jasper Road, and if we had five since then, I don't know that we've looked at five. Is there some that have been additions to existing sites?
Well,
I don't think we've actually had five that we've gone through the approval process since Jasper Road.
So this doesn't include the one that wasn't built that came up last year, right? Because that was up.
Close to five. I think so.
Well, I know it's the South 28th, and we had the latest view. So I don't know.
Well, there's one in South 28th.
Yeah, that's what I'm just
thinking. Oh, yeah.
We had May of 2015, 4164 Jasper Road. In November of 2015, we had 4992 Main Street. In April of 2016, we had South 28th Street. In October of 16, we had 2037 Laura Street. And then, I guess, we haven't done Vitus Lane yet, have we? They just rezoned that property.
No, that came
through. Oh, it did prove
that, yeah.
Okay, those are the ones. Okay. Those are the ones you guys have done.
Yeah, and one other question. Even though that particular parcel was permissible to have a 150-foot tower, we could ask them to say, would a 100-foot tower cover the coverage gap and still allow for co-location?
Yeah, you can ask them that, sure.
You could ask them that, and you could have required an independent analysis to evaluate that.
Yeah, because it was within 500 feet, I mean, regardless, but we could have asked that.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, sure.
And what about concern for setback, you know, as far as the issue related to less and least intrusive.
Right.
I mean, that's even though it was within, it met our requirements for setback in the code. However, there was a concern definitely voiced by commission that said that is really intrusive, that close to Pioneer Parkway.
The thing that I would say is that in making those decisions, you really need to make sure that you are tying that intrusiveness to the, you know, visually intrusive and those types of things.
Right,
and
exactly.
Not tying it to
the
expressed concerns from the neighbors about EMF and
Absolutely. We cannot deal with the EMF issue. I mean, that is a federal issue. That's very clear. But it's good to know that, you know, that's part of our role, and we have the ability to voice those issues when we're in session. So,
I was going to say, I remember you asked the consultant on that Laura Street property whether or not the pole could be located further from Pioneer Parkway, and the response, as I recall, the response was the owner wouldn't allow that. It was either in that spot or nowhere on that property. And they had talked to several other property owners on Water Street who said no. So I guess then the circumstance you're confronted with is if you feel that they've exhausted any other potential sites for this that weren't as intrusive or didn't have the same the visual impact that you were distressed about on Pioneer Parkway because it's an entrance, and they said, well, this is the only property owner who said yes.
So how, where's the burden of proof there? I mean, is there any burden of proof? I mean, do we have to take them for their word? Could we say, provide us additional information for the other property owners that you have contacted?
Like an affidavit or something?
The burden
something,
is preponderance of the, you can hold them to a preponderance of the evidence standard.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That you find it's more likely than not what evidence you require to meet that burden.
So if they make a statement like that, they have to have the information to back up what it is that they're saying, right? Yes?
You can require that.
We can require that.
Yeah, I mean, you weren't saying it. They were saying it.
Yeah,
they said
exactly.
They nobody was interested. And this person was, but only on this piece of, only at this location, not 250 feet to the west, which was also on that property.
Okay.
So we could accept that as, you know, as a statement of truth, which I think is a reasonable acceptance. But we could say, because of the visual obtrusiveness, we're going to require you to provide the mapping to show everything from 75 feet to 125 feet to see whether it'll cover your coverage gap. That would be a reasonable conclusion, to accept their initial statements as statements of fact.
Well,
and at the same time, try to reduce the visual impact.
I mean, I think the pole height's 150 feet.
Right.
So obviously, a 120 foot pole is permitted too.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
So the question would be, coverage as well as continued ability for co-location,
mm-hmm.
or I don't know that we mandate that the towers be available for co-location
or
do. Not. We
yes.
mandate.
Yeah. 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 Well, yes. It's on the same. It's the same standard. It's stated in the same place as less intrusive, and so you can weigh these against each other. It's not for us to tell you which one is more important. They're all listed as standards that need to be established. So. If standards are sometimes mutually exclusive, in that intrusiveness and co-location are inversely related, the higher the tower, the more obtrusive, but maybe the better it is for co-location. I don't know if that's accurate or not. You could determine how you are going to weigh those standards against each other.
Yes.
The area that I'm interested in is the subject of co-location. When we first started looking at tower applications, co-location was a key element of the consideration in approving the application. And in the last couple of applications we had, it hardly was mentioned in regard to co-location. So the question I have is, in code 4.3-145A, it states, maximize the use of existing WTS facilities in order to minimize the need to construct additional facilities. So the question I have is, how is the city maximizing this element of co-location? Because as an example, say provider XYZ wanted to locate a tower on Vitus Butte, and then provider ABC comes to the city and says, we're looking at constructing a tower in the area of Vitus Butte. Is the city able to suggest to ABC that they contact XYZ and explore the possibility of co-location? Is there anything where the city has on file information on what towers have available location opportunities and what towers don't? I mean, it's kind of a shopping process I could visualize if the information was available.
So they wouldn't be allowed to put another one on right as view because of that 200.
No, but I mean, this is a general example.
They would at least get the information of you can't put one there, there's already one there, and this is the applicant.
Well, the question is though.
This information that's updated and available for those companies to be able to see what's out there and available.
Well, because there's a tower doesn't necessarily mean that there's an opening for co-location. So that's, because in other words, if they're shopping for a location, they're either going to look at building a new tower or they're going to look to co-locate. What leverage does the city have to maximize the use of existing facilities?
Well, so that they don't build one.
So that they don't build. In other words, how do we control extra towers simply because nobody is attempting to relocate?
It's a setback.
It's actually required in the application that they allow for co-location. I mean, it's a requirement that they do.
I know, but if everybody builds a tower and they allow for co-location, that means there's available spots everywhere. Who's the next person that's going to look to co-locate before
they in the recent ones that I've reviewed, they've listed all of the...
Alternate
the sites. Applicants have all listed all of the other towers in their search area. Stated whether they were available for co-location or not.
Or whether they'd fill the coverage gap.
Because in essence...
Right.
You can eliminate a number of towers simply by saying, instead of looking at putting up a new tower, look to co-locate with an existing provider.
I don't think those applications make it to the city, because I think where they find those co-locations, they're doing that.
That
would be a lot, frankly, a lot cheaper for them.
I think that, you know, from a financial standpoint, it's to their advantage to co-locate as well, because of the cost of placing a tower.
And they don't have to go through the same process because
they don't have to go. It's much faster. No planning process.
Well, if we assume that the technology is the same with respect to line of sight and height, having a broader area of coverage, and these people are building towers of this height, it's either because that's as tall as we'll let them go, or that's how tall they need to go for them, for their success. So anybody who's down below them, where the co-location occurs, is going to be reducing their area of coverage just by the fact that they're lower. They're not as high up. And so then the question becomes, what Commissioner Quaglow said is, if there's a tower nearby that might be suitable for another company to co-locate, except it's only 120 feet high, and co-locating on there is not going to solve their problem. They're still going to have a gap because they're not up high enough. Then, okay, there's one nearby that is available for co-location, but it won't work for us because it's not tall enough. It's in the right area, but it's not tall enough. So we have to go over here 2,000 feet away and negotiate for a site and go up 150 feet. That's just the technology. Now, I don't know. I mean, when I look at this map, I see a lot of opportunities for more cell towers.
Yeah.
You know, even with the 2,000-foot thing, there's still... There's two large sites, although Commissioner James might not agree, but there's two large sites out in Thurston that are still good. There's several sites on the other side of the hill on Bob Straw. There's still some sites in Q Street area and north of Marcola Meadows. Actually, in Marcola Meadows, you can do one. So there's still a lot of, there's a potential probably for at least a half a dozen more cell towers in the city, I would guess.
Yes.
How, maybe one of you knows the answer. I mean, how high can you build a tower where you really can't camouflage it? I mean, you know, I understand what the guys were saying on the last one. It's like, well, it's a 150-foot tower. It's not going to look like a 150-foot perjury. You know, what's the practical
for the monopine?
Yeah, well, or the double branch kind of thing that we did on Jasper, you know.
Let's see, you approved...
We did a 125 at Midas. I think
you've
that was
approved
125 foot.
a 90-foot monopine and a 85-foot monopine.
Around 125-foot was the last one, 100. Vitus Lane was a monopine.
Oh, it was.
And that was 125, if I recall correctly.
Very low, that one looks like, does it look okay?
It was against a hill and against trees.
Yeah.
You probably get some bond just really excited if you had 150-foot in town. They might go, wow.
Well, that's what I'm asking, you know, what's reasonable? 150-foot, that's pretty big.
Keep in mind that you do regulate where camouflaged monopine towers are required versus where high visibility are required. So to the extent that something's in the right zoning, for a high visibility, it may be outside of the reasonable conditions for you to impose to require them to put in a different classification of facility. So to require them to place a monopine instead of.
And this last situation that we were in, they were in industrial property, and we only require, you know, high visibility is appropriate in that area. So it would not necessarily have been within our jurisdiction to say, you know, we want you to put a pine tree there, right? A monopine there.
Right.
Although.
I think that would violate the purpose of having those.
Well, because, yeah, and I mean, the code states clearly that in that property designation, they can put. Just a standard high visibility.
You know, if we could demonstrate that it didn't have this chilling effect on placement and ultimately the perception, you probably could identify corridors that are of high value for their aesthetic attributes.
Without revising the code.
I think we need to revise the code, but that's one way you could address it.
Yes.
I don't think there's a way to address it otherwise, because it's really not there. We don't have view shed or that kind of aesthetic standard in our code.
For streets. For residential, there is.
But not
right.
Not just traveling down a street. There's not that. You know, another big sigh of relief we can take, in that first code we had lattice towers were permitted in heavy industrial.
Yeah.
They didn't have the technology to build 150-foot poles at that time, so things that were that high and higher were on the lattice towers. Dodge that bullet. We had a couple of those out there.
I think one of the first applications we looked at was the lattice tower, and that's where the question came up of, can we alter the appearance of this somehow? Because it looks like a contraption, it just fell.
Well, it's an erector set type of thing. Yeah, it's not good.
But I've kind of reached the conclusion that now that the Jasper Road Tower is up and operating, and I drive by it all the time, because that's out in my area, it's a whatever height tower, which is above the height of all the surrounding fir trees, and it's a pseudo pine tree, and the apparatus extends beyond the end of the limbs, I end up with a question of mine, and considering also going into other jurisdictions, I notice there's many other jurisdictions that either don't even have any aspect of their code regarding monopines and that, and they're just cell towers. I've kind of reached the conclusion in my mind, I'm not sure whether this guy's cell towers are worth all the trouble.
Because it's not a very effective disguise.
Well, and that's, plus it's a big headache for the provider. And like the example of the tower on Olympic Street, which is from way back before we had all the code.
Yeah.
Not many people driving down the street are going, oh, gee, that's an undisguised tower, other than on the freeway. So in my mind, I've reached a conclusion that this disguising process is questionable in my mind at this point.
Well, I don't think it is in a residential, in a residential setting.
I think we have a 30-foot height limit in residential.
Yeah, 30-foot.
But we allow them disguised in PLO, and there are pockets of PLO,
PLO
and is around
yeah.
by residential.
I think Vitus Butte is a real good example of what, one where the disguise, I think, worked really well, at least if it comes out looking anything like the photo sims, which I think it probably will. It's really effective, I think.
So, you know, I think you've demonstrated or stated pretty clearly where the flexibility is, you know, in determining the need, and that we have the ability to say, you know, or require some third-party verification of that. That's an option that we have.
Yeah, so I don't have a trouble with that per se.
Sure.
None at all, because it's in here. The trouble I have is 120-day time limit on getting these things approved.
Yes.
That's what we have. We're the mandamus after that. So the question then becomes one of, should we communicate this to the applicants when they first contact us and alert them to these sections of the code?
I would think that would be a good thing to do, you know.
Well, there's a difference to pointing out that exists, and it's possible based on the presentation and the testimony that the Planning Commission could say, you know, we want an independent peer review of this. And we want some sort of confirmation other than just in your testimony that you tried and couldn't succeed. We want some further confirmation of that attempt and that denial. I mean, it's one thing to tell them they have to do it. It's another thing to tell them that it's there and the possibility may exist that they could be required to go this additional step, because it is there. It's just not often invoked.
Yeah.
And it can be required up front too, is another thing to point out. Technically, it's the director that has of the development and public works permit that has the authority to order that. So certainly the Planning Commission could direct the director to order that, but if that step, that requirement could be imposed even before the public hearing if it was the direction from the Planning Commission that as a matter of course, for every application that is within 500 feet of residential, for example, you would require.
The other possibility, too, is that the ones that come to you first are referred to the council. And the council has the ability to review the application on its own rather than have the Planning Commission do it. I don't suppose it would be a stretch to have the council direct the applicant to provide that information, but have the Planning Commission hear the hearing anyway. There's no real
guidance. The council would direct the director.
Or direct the director.
But
yeah.
Not direct the
right.
That determination could be made by.
So the council could do that too. If that was there.
Well, I think there were a couple of things that came up on this last go around for me, you know, was the proximity to the the community or the housing, you know, across Pioneer Parkway, and the obtrusive the look of that thing within the space. And I think, you know, as long as the directors are aware that, you know, those things might be considered when, I don't think we need to direct anybody, mm-hmm. but those things are, with your seated, you know, although you heard Commissioner Vose say, you know, I'm not so sure, especially on the, you know, camouflage style trees or tree, the monopines. However, that really was out of play in this one anyway, because we, you know, it was in the correct zoning to have a high visibility.
Right.
So when we're talking about high visibility, close to a residential zoning, and within a, in a view shed or in a corridor, I think that was what kind of popped to the top for me in this particular instance. So I think, you know, it would be prudent, you know, for, to have that conversation at a DIM meeting or whatever it is that you do prior to just make them aware that the Planning Commission certainly could invoke this, that's within their, you know, their jurisdiction to do so, and that because of the proximity to residential and because of this view shed, that could be something they might choose to do. So they should be aware of that, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that makes perfect sense to me. Mm-hmm.
And in addition, I'd say that also the alternative height analysis to see that a particular, you know, although you can't say, well, we need a camouflage one, but to say, you know, I think it was reasonable in that case to say, would a 100-foot tower cover your coverage gap? And if so, I think we could have said, we don't want 150.
I think I recall him saying that we need that height to get the coverage that we need.
The idea would be that you could require
peer review
to verify,
exactly.
that statement.
Exactly.
Or to provide some analysis, exactly. Of, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Rather than just take my word for it, right. You know, we've done the work and here it is. That's great, but.
Well, we'll find out this week if there is either like a trade organization or if there are independent,
yeah, that would be
engineers who were qualified to do this kind of peer review.
And it's at the cost of the applicant, right?
Absolutely.
We would inform the applicant that it's possible we would require peer review, or we believe because it's in close proximity to residential, that if they're going to have to demonstrate their only opportunity is at site X at that height, and then we would obviously say it's likely that we'll require a peer review to confirm that. See if there's a margin to bring it down a little.
Of course, the force working against that is a higher tower is more expensive to construct. So that's good. I mean, no one is going to say we're building 150 just because we can.
Right.
Well, actually, that guy said he was in the business of building towers, the gentleman who made the application. He was in the business of building towers, and he made his money on the taller towers because of
because of the greater coverage,
money from
the provider.
So,
yeah, right. He made money through leasing. I was telling Sean that he was probably the worst presenter I've ever seen do for the cell phone time. He was very brash and not very professional and didn't really.
So,
well, he may not be used to groups like we have reviewing these things. So it'll be a new experience for him.
So those are the main areas then, yeah, that the commission can have some discretion through these processes. And I think you've done a really good job framing that for us. I think that sets the stage pretty well for us.
There are certainly other standards in there that have discretionary components. It might be a good exercise before the next one of these comes up, apart from the packet, to just sit down and really look through,
yeah,
as a group the section 4.3-145, which has all those standards, because they're in the staff report, they're discussed one by one, and you don't really read through the whole picture of how they interplay with each other.
4.3-145.
As a suggestion, perhaps at the time of the next application, we could have a work session
prior to
just to discuss the different,
yeah, criteria. Could you guys pull together just those discretionary pieces? Are they all at one spot?
It's F or are they, and G. Okay. So F and G in there. Almost all of these are discretionary to some level. Very few of them are specific enough that we would view them as ministerial standards only.
Yeah, 145 is 5 or 6 pages long, so.
Yeah, I still like his idea, though, you know, that if we kind of could bash around amongst us, so we go in there kind of knowing where we're going already. I like that.
Great.
Okay.
Cool. Thank you very much.
Yeah, anything else?
Very helpful.
All right, thank you so much. We're adjourned.